Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things I've been talking about here recently is there have been some forces out there trying to pitch us this idea that maybe a return to the good old days, a return to the company town, might not be a bad thing. Maybe, you know, a company like Amazon with Bezos and the need for these big complexes, maybe if they had, you know, reasonable houses right there, you know, maybe if you got workers some reasonable cost housing, you know, right there, transportation, build these little utopian worker communities, it would be great. I got to tell you, I look back to the past where we had those kind of things, and it did not end well for working people. Not at all. And here to share some thoughts on this resurgent idea of are we better now? Are we smarter? Can we have company towns again? I've asked our good friend John Shelton to come back and share some thoughts with us. John is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. Hi, Rick.
So I'm in this spot, John, where I'm looking at these stories and I'm seeing a couple of them starting to sprout up. This idea, you know, hey, this company town idea might not be a bad idea. We could surround the factory with, you know, reasonably cost housing that the employees can have. Sounds almost utopian.
Yeah, you know, so I'm guessing the big piece that's been kind of making the rounds is that piece in Bloomberg, you know, which was sort of arguing, you know, can these sort of Amazon company towns lead to a more sustainable set of jobs for working class people? And, you know, it ignores a lot of things, right? I mean, so on the one hand, as you said, it ignores the history of company towns in this country. And, you know, there's an interesting parallel because I don't think it's a surprise that we're talking about this at a moment when workers really have, you know, at least for the past few decades, a historic amount of leverage. The labor market's tight. There's a so-called, job shortage, which effectively means, or worker shortage, which effectively means that workers just have a choice and yep. where they can go and can actually drive up wages. And, you know, that was a lot of these company towns. You know, there's probably a lot of examples that your listeners are familiar with. I mean, this was sort of a strategy of Ford. But, you know, you could also look at some somewhat less famous examples like Pullman in Illinois, right, that you know, made the Pullman luxury cars. And in Wisconsin, we've got Kohler, right? Which, you know, effectively kind of set up as at least an experiment in a company town in the 1920s. And part of the rationale for that, you know, was about reducing worker turnover and keeping workers, right? By, you know, effectively kind of creating something of a captive audience because workers have to be there. It's a pain in the ass to move, or maybe they can't afford to move. And it strikes me that that's a big part of this conversation now is like trying to find, you know, arguments, you know, sort of artificial ways to keep workers on the job, you know, rather than being able to, you know, go out and seek other gigs in this, you know, historically good moment for them.
Yeah. The great resignation, we're calling it.
Yeah. So that's number one. But number two, you know, one of the arguments is that, you know, say Amazon, for example, is paying, you know, really good wages for that sector of work. I think, you know, they're offering in some places $17-$18 bucks an hour. But, you know, what that really ignores is that, you know, so much of what makes a job good and so much of what makes a job, you know, have dignity is workers having a say. And so it's not just about the wages. So much of this is about, I mean, I know you know this concept and probably a lot of your listeners do too, industrial democracy. The idea that, you know, workers should have a union so they have some say over their, you know, working conditions so that those workers in Amazon can take breaks. So they can take bathroom breaks so they can, you know, make sure they're not being physically crushed as we've heard from so many of those workers what the accounts of working there is like. And so, you know, any kind of sustainable future for workers involves the right to a union. And so with a union busting company like Amazon, you know, this just isn't going to move the needle. And a company town is almost like a funhouse mirror version of, you know, industrial democracy.
No, and one of the things that on the industrial democracy front is ownership. I believe, you know, as having a union and having a voice, you have some ownership of that job where you're not an at-will employee. And it's one of those things where, you know, the turnover rates that are going on right now, especially in places like Amazon, I can see how this would be something that they would want. If they, we can get you into this company housing, we're going to get you, you know, kind of trapped in here a little bit. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, when I first moved to Pennsylvania back in 93, I met a guy who, he told me the story of his family, who, when he got back from Vietnam, they had given him some money when he left the military. And he came back here to Central Pennsylvania and paid his family's debt to the company store. And that had been the only time in the history of that family that they were not indebted to that company store. And I, that story sticks with me because, you know, that's in my lifetime that somebody was attached to one of these company stores, to one of these company towns, and in a lifetime of debt. And you go, the history of this, not great. And I don't know why they're, and the Bloomberg piece is the one that's gotten the most attention, but I've seen other people try and make these arguments that, you know, we need benevolent dictators. We have these wealthy people and they're going to take care of us. This movie, this sequel, not going to end any better than the last one.
Yeah. You know, and it's crazy to me, you know, having this conversation, how out of touch these pundits are with, you know, regular America, people who work for a living. So, you know, we were chatting a little bit before this segment about how, you know, my students are back in person this semester. One of my classes is, you know, it's an upper division seminar course called U.S. Labor in the Working Class. And I'm super excited to be doing it. It's the first time I've done it in a couple of years. And we were actually talking about Amazon and company towns today. And my students are working class students. You know, many of them are the first in their generation to go to college. Some of them, like, it's funny because the Kohler example came up almost immediately because I had a student who had actually worked in the Kohler plant and you know, was telling us about that history. But when I kind of asked them, you know, what do you know about company towns, or what do you think of when you think about company towns? You know, several students immediately brought up the idea of the company store. That is, you know, something that is seared into popular culture. And it's amazing to me that working people and the sons and daughters of working class families think of that, right? We've got a whole, you know, the famous, I think it was Tennessee Ernie Ford that has the most famous version of 16 Tons, you know, with that famous line about the company store. People know about this, right? And, but the fact that you have people at, you know, these journalists at these major media outlets like Bloomberg that are so out of touch with that history and that legacy, and would even write something, you know, making that argument without thinking about that legacy, to me is just mind-boggling. I understand it, but it's still tough to take.
Is it that they're out of touch, or is it that we're pushing a frame? You know, I look at a lot of what these right-wing think tanks do, the trial balloons they throw, the narratives they spew out. This seemed to me that trial balloon to see what kind of reactions Americans would give to the idea of reviving this horrible idea from the past. And I don't think it got the kind of pushback that it should have.
You know, my internet cut out for a second. What was the first part of what you said?
You know, the first part was because you had said that, you know, the media pundits didn't know or chose. Yeah. I believe that they probably know, but they chose to ignore it. Because like a lot of the right-wing think tanks, they're pushing a narrative and they've got an agenda. And you know, to me, that's what this is, to see what kind of pushback that they would get. And I don't think they've gotten the kind of pushback that it should.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the second part. I'm not sure about the first. I mean, if you think about an outlet like Bloomberg, right, it's one of these, like, you know, I think it would purport to be center left, right? I mean,
but that was an opinion piece. That wasn't an article. That was an opinion piece. And I think, you know, if you don't know it's an opinion piece, then you can make that assumption.
Yes.
But my view, that's an opinion piece. So they're putting their name on that narrative.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. But I think what I would say is, you know, you have like a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like a professional pundit class in this country that is so out of touch that argument actually makes sense to them. Like, I want to be charitable and actually think, like, you know, maybe this is somebody who cares about working class livelihoods and is just so out of touch that they don't know about that history. Yeah. And can't see how wildly ludicrous that argument is.
Yeah, the same people who pitched us the free trade argument during the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. To me, that's where I see this, right? Like, you know, I don't think Clinton, for example, right, negotiating NAFTA, had some kind of nefarious agenda. I think he was just clueless, and and he had these supposedly smart people around him telling him, "Hey, this is going to help working class livelihoods," when you had all of labor saying, "No, it won't. You don't need to have an economics degree to know that this is not going to help our jobs when you can pay somebody much less money, for the same work that doesn't have a union."
Yeah. Now, the thing that gets me is you said that Amazon's paying good wages. As someone who, grew up, in the workforce back in the 80s, a unionized workforce back then was making superior wages to what Amazon is paying. So my point of reference is, I worked in a warehouse for one of the big hardware chains back in the mid to late 80s, and was making like 10, 11 bucks an hour, which in today's dollars would be like 22, 25 bucks an hour. With healthcare, with retirement, with vacation, with all of those things, and job security. So when I think of what a good warehouse job is, that's what I think of. I don't think of Amazon. Now, Amazon, because of this moment, they're having to pay more, and they're having to think of outside the box on how they're going to keep people. And it's going to be interesting to see where they go. But I'm not putting them in that good job category yet.
No, 100%. I mean, you're totally right there, and so much of this is about the historical context, right? So, I think I just looked at this pretty recently. The numbers of the AFL-CIO, basically the updated numbers are, if just the minimum wage stayed where it was in, say, 1968, if it had kept up with worker productivity, right? That wages for workers right now should be about $24, $25 an hour. So, this is connected to the class war from above, right? The efforts of corporations to suppress wages. Again, we see this right now in this really hyperventilation about a so-called worker shortage, and what it's really about is not being able to get workers at subpar wages anymore because they have some choices. But yeah, I mean, to say that a $17, $18 an hour job with no union rights, practically speaking, and this brutal work regime that we know lots of people are working under, where they're afraid to take bathroom breaks, that's not a good job. That's not a job with dignity. But it shows you that just how far our expectations, and I don't mean you and I, of course, we have high expectations, but that our expectations as a society for what counts as a good job, it shows how far out of whack they are. So I think that's a really good point.
No, and all I have to look at for Amazon is their turnover numbers. That plant in Bessemer, Alabama, had in excess of 100% turnover. I worked for a company for 20 years who they touted the fact that they had a less than 2% turnover rate per year. And they were proud of that because they retained good employees, they trained good people, and those employees made them money. I look at the Amazon model where they're just churning through people at an alarming rate in a model that is unsustainable. And at some point they have to do something. So it's my view. I'm looking at this company town thing as the trial balloon of going, how can we trap people? How can we get them into lease agreements? How can we get them into the housing? How can we hold them back? And this to me seems like that. Now, maybe me just being paranoid, I don't know, but that's what it seems like. And again, it's just one of those things that it is what it is. But John, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work that you do. As always, good stuff, my friend. Thanks so much. I hope you come back and talk to us again real soon.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I'd love that. Have a good night, and have a good night to your listeners.
Thanks so much, John Shelton, professor there at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Look, as I said, one of the things that's most concerning to me is that they normalize this stuff. And we don't push back hard enough and fast enough. Just my thoughts. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, on the talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.